We're happy this afternoon to have with us Dr. August Silflo, who is the director of the Concordia Historical Institute, who is adjunct professor in the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, who is a member of Synod's Task Force on the Constitution, the Bylaws, and Structure of Synod. Hence, Dr. Silflo is a man who is very knowledgeable in such areas as Synod's history and Synod's constitutional structure. And so we felt that he was a man who could share with us in a very meaningful way the lecture and now this interview, the topic on the autonomy of the local congregation. And we're going to sort of slant this topic in the direction of special reference to calling a pastor. First of all, Dr. Silflo, I'd like to ask you, how would you define congregational autonomy?
Well, Dr. Schmidt, I think several elements should be focused upon at this point. Number one, I think that it would be better to speak in terms of congregational polity than autonomy. I think that the word autonomy is no longer a neutral word, whereas polity is a little more neutral. I think we've gotten ourselves into some difficulty by trying to define too precisely what congregational autonomy is because of the use of the term autonomy. Now let me back up a little bit. I think that the Lutherans of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod probably have experienced a real traumatic situation all the way back in the late 1830s. When they were involved in a very close-knit kind of a government, which one might almost call hierarchical or militaristic, when the leader proved to be unfaithful in that kind of a situation, there was almost a complete collapse and chaos. So they backed away, as one would understand, totally from a very rigid form of church government.
May I just interrupt
yeah.
here? Wasn't the leader even declaring himself a bishop of sorts
yes,
at that
yes,
time?
He yes, he was the first Lutheran bishop in America.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in the negative sense is an indication of the kind of church government that was being envisioned.
Now, that was Martin Stephan, of course.
That was Martin
yes.
Stephan.
Right.
One could, of course, give evidence of the compliance to his orders that the bishop demanded. So it was not an evangelical nor a pastoral kind of a relationship that existed in that structure. But these people bounced away from that kind of a governmental concept totally and took their refuge in the existence of the local parish. And out of this then emerged the concept of congregational polity, where really the congregation is synonymous with the church, and that all major decisions should be made on the congregational level rather than on some other level or by an individual, regardless of what by what term he calls himself. Now out of this came a merger then, or let's say a union of congregations, and the extremist concept of congregational independence or separatism was then blended and sort of homogenized as one congregation joined hands with another congregation and reached the conclusion that as we take a look at what the church really ought to be doing, we are incapable of doing this totally by ourselves. We need the support of our fellow Christians in the other congregations. And in order to accomplish that, they established what we call today the Synod. They didn't, and I think here you can notice the hesitation, they didn't want to call it a church. They called it a Synod to give an indication that it was a segment of the church, not the church. But in this process of trying to do things together and to do them more effectively, jointly, these congregations also were willing to yield some of these responsibilities that they considered of the utmost importance. And that's where I think we get sort of an ambivalence today. We, all of us, I think, as being the sons and daughters of our own history, want to preserve the congregational polity. But at the same time, we do realize that there are certain tasks which a fragmented kind of polity would not allow us to accomplish. The local congregation with the Christians who worship there and who serve and who witness are the people who basically determine the manner in which this can be done and how the resources can be utilized in order to achieve certain goals. Mm-hmm. Now, when we get to the next level, and this is where I left off before, when you think in terms of certain tasks that require the support of several congregations, because none of them can accomplish them independently. I'm thinking in terms, for example, of both foreign and home mission work. Now, many congregations in the earlier phases of our synodical history assumed total responsibility for the mission work that was to be done within a radius of 200 miles or even 250, 300 miles of their home base. This is marvelous. But if that congregation does not have the manpower or the financial resources to assume that kind of responsibility, it requires the help of others. And that's where we get involved in a synodical structure with a mission board. Same thing is true of doing work in a foreign country. If a congregation could send a missionary to wherever, islands of the Pacific, and salary that missionary, I think this would be a marvelous thing. But there are very few congregations who have that kind of a resource available. So we do it in concert with one another. And again, this means that as a member of a congregation, I may have to yield a little bit in order to accomplish together with others. A second area would be the training of professional workers in the church, pastors and teachers. If a congregation could establish its own seminary, and in colonial Lutheranism there were those who tried it, but it didn't work because they didn't have enough support for that within their own parish. So we band together in order to support our colleges, our seminaries, and we have to engage in boards that administer this kind of work in the name of the congregations. But the congregations, again, under congregational polity, are the ones who, through a convention, determine the overall and broad policies. I think that also the synod itself has spoken rather directly about the conditions of membership. Voluntarily, congregations have said that we want to join forces with other congregations who follow the same policies that we have established for ourselves. Article 6 of the Synodical Constitution speaks about the various elements that are involved in one congregation joining forces with another. Or another way of saying this would be, what does one congregation expect from another when it joins the synod and remains a member within the synod? So that I think that if you speak about the congregational polity, there is so very, very much that speaks or that commends it to our current efforts to try to serve and to work and to witness. But at the same time, we cannot overemphasize it so that we can get some joint activity and joint service which will go beyond that of the local congregation.
Well, thank you for that answer, Dr. Soufflot. And I think we hit quite a few bases in that particular answer. You refer to Article 6 of the Constitution, and you made passing reference also as to the reason for our coming together as a synod. You mentioned some of them. Maybe you'd like to review for our listeners what really were some of the basic objectives or reasons for the synod's beginning in the first place, and I guess they're just as valid today, aren't they?
Yes, they certainly are. In spite of the the long history that so many churches, including ours, have had. But when I review the history of the Missouri Synod particularly, and again within the context of congregational polity, I think there is one overarching concern that these congregations which formed the Synod in 1847 shared with one another, and that is to come out with a common confession of faith. They were born within a confusion of theology. The 1830s and the 1840s in America established a kind of confusion that had to be overcome somehow. And so, in order to get the job done together, they established their confessional platform, which bespeaks adherence to the Holy Scriptures as the written word of God, and also to the historic Lutheran confessions, which are detailed in Article 2, as being the common confessional theological ground, a sort of a shorthand that they could speak to one another and say that we believe, teach, and confess these things in common. We share them with one another.
I recall during your lecture, Dr. Suho, you made the comment concerning Article 2 that other synods at the time said, oh, this will never work. Thank God it has worked, and is still working today.
The Missouri Synod was considered a maverick for having adopted the kind of confessional platform it did in Article 2, because there were many who were moving away from subscription to the Lutheran confessions. Mm-hmm. And this is one thing that has provided a cohesiveness to the Missouri Synod, which has been really quite unbelievable to other people, to others outside of the Synod. They speak of the Missouri Synod as being really a family kind of a relationship. And so it has been. But in addition to that, there is that cohesiveness of a theology which permeates everything. And I think, too, that here, I like to think about Article 2 as being a launching pad. It is the theology which motivates the church to move in the area of professional training, higher education, in home and foreign missions, in a stewardship life, in a life of serving the social needs of our communities and of our cities, world hunger, and you name it. Rather than let's say a structure or a program that is being forced upon people, it is the theology which produces these results. Action coming out of the faith,
right?
And this has been one of the real strengths, as I see it, of the Missouri Synod.
Right. You mentioned something about rather than having some program forced upon. I think this is a very natural way then to lead into Article 7, which speaks about the relation of the Synod to its members, and which reads, in its relation to its members, the Synod is not an ecclesiastical government exercising legislative or coercive powers, and with respect to the individual congregation's right of self-government, it is but an advisory body. Accordingly, no resolution of the Synod imposing anything upon the individual congregation is of binding force if it is not in accordance with the Word of God, or if it appears to be inexpedient as far as the condition of a congregation is concerned. And I know the last few years, some congregations or spokesmen for congregations have seized upon that word inexpedient. I noticed here, too, there's an asterisk, and it says that one should see bylaws 109B. Well, I turned to that a while ago and reminded myself what it says there. And there it sort of defines this expediency, and it says the Synod, being an advisory body, recognizes the right of the congregation to be the judge of the expediency as applied to its local condition. Then it adds, however, in exercising such judgment, the congregation must not act arbitrarily, but in accordance with the principles of Christian love and charity. And here, of course, we both know that people have grasped upon this idea of congregational autonomy, and they've said, now, this really isn't expedient for us, and since we, of course, are ruling ourselves, and it isn't going to force anything down our throat, we just won't do it. Maybe you'd like to comment on that.
That article, I think, too, is extremely unique. I think you won't find an article comparable to that in any Lutheran literature in America anywhere. You may find it in some very highly decentralized denominations. I think, frankly, that it's been very unfortunate that that article has not been examined in its historical context. I believe very strongly that if we would look at the article in the history in which it was conceived and in which it was born, that we would be in a far better position to understand what those who formulated it really intended to say. All too frequently, we superimpose our own concepts on the article, and we ignore its historical environment. Now, having said this, I think that it has bothered me for a long time that there are some myths that have sprung up about this particular article. The first myth is that the Missouri Synod has had this article since its very beginning in 1847. It did not, and the historical facts will bear that out. Our time won't allow us to go into that in any more detail. Number two, the original paragraph, which is the antecedent paragraph of the present Article 7, was couched in entirely different language. If one would take the time and to compare those two terminologies, I think that you would find that there would be no misunderstanding about the original text, but there have been so many misunderstandings and misinterpretations about the present text that one wonders why we haven't readopted the original text.
When you say original,
all that confusion.
Yes. When you say original, I'm sure you're referring to the German text, the original German text.
Text which became official in the Missouri Synod by 1854. Now, it does it does go back that far. But I think, for example, the original text speaks about the congregation's right of self-government and uses the expression, the German expression of Selbstregierung.
Yes.
Now, there is that Selbstregierung, or self-government, has been interpreted in the history of the Synod in the same way in which I talked about congregational polity in the earlier part of our discussion this afternoon. The self-government gave to the individual congregation the right that it could call its own pastors and teachers, not in without any parameters, however, but from that group which the congregations had said, we're going to train for our future use. The congregations, through the servant structure of the synod, were involved in preparing pastors and teachers. Now, in order to fill their future need, the second self-government principle that they had was to own their own property. Now, this was, again, one of those matters that was contrary to the thinking of many, because the larger church, the synod, the structure beyond the congregation, owned the property. In fact, there are many churches even today where the denominational officers or the corporate body owns the local parish's property. Or at least, and there is one church that if a congregation leaves that Lutheran church, it leaves its property behind because that belongs to the church body. So that was the second one where we differed on self-government. The third one was in disciplining the members of the local congregation. In the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, there is no procedure by which a member of a parish can be disciplined. That's the responsibility of the local congregation, and we have felt within the Missouri Synod that this is the way it ought to be.
Let me just inject here, however, if a member of a congregation feels that his congregation has not given him or her justice, then this member can appeal
then
to
appeal.
A synod, right?
Yes,
yes.
That's mm-hmm. right. So there is recourse available if yes. an injustice has
yes.
been created.
Yes.
But the synod would never step in and tell a congregation, you have to excommunicate
right.
such and such an individual because of such action.
Yes.
That's the parish responsibility. Then, in the fourth place, this self-government also meant that the congregation could establish its parish government to apply its own programs, financial policies, and determine what it intended to do, its own mission program, its own stewardship program, its own educational program, and the like. So the self-government, in that respect, did not mean autonomy. It did not mean that the congregation was a law unto itself, but rather it had certain rights, prerogatives, liberties, responsibilities, which it did carry out conscientiously, independently, and others it carried out in concert with their fellow congregations.
Mm-hmm. So I recall in your lecture you gave the original German word than which you feel the English word inexpedient doesn't exactly meet.
Yes, I think inexpedient is a very unfortunate term because, as Abraham Lincoln once said, that the farmer who kills the wolf who destroys the sheep, that wolf feels that it was very inexpedient for the farmer to do that.
Yes.
And on the other hand, the sheep feel that it was expedient. So it depends on what your point of view is at that particular moment. Who's going to be the judge of the expediency, in other words?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the original German was a term ungeeignet, and I think that if we take a look at that meaning, we'll find that it would be much, much more effectively translated as meaning unfit, unapplicable,
mm-hmm.
or even out of season. So that one could say that you can easily judge whether something is applicable or not.
Right.
If somebody asks you to paint your schoolhouse in a congregation, to paint the schoolhouse yellow, and you don't have a schoolhouse,
mm-hmm.
You know immediately that this is unapplicable.
Right.
It's not inexpedient for you to not to paint this. So I think that's one of the distinctions. I have often regretted that in making that translation, our forefathers did not cast about for a word that was a little more representative of the original. And this, too, as you have indicated, created some of the confusion that we have today.
Let me just ask a general question now, which I think will tie together a lot of these things you've said so far, Dr. Silflo. And that is this. Why cannot a congregation or the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod call anyone to be its pastor?
In theory, I suppose backing away from this as far as one possibly can, in theory, one could say that a congregation in the literature of the Missouri Synod has a right to call anyone. It could call the janitor to be serving as its pastor if this is what it wanted. However, in again, working together with other congregations and having joined the synod, it has agreed to working within a certain procedural fashion. First of all, it has established certain criteria that it wants its professional workers to meet. There are countless resolutions that our pastors and our teachers are required to meet these standards. So the congregation has eliminated, through that action, the possibility of calling someone who is illiterate. It couldn't do it. It has given up something. Secondly, the congregation has also, by joining forces with others, put down other criteria, particularly in Article 6 of the Synodical Constitution, which requires that the pastors and the teachers who are called from one of three sources. The first source is that which has been provided for through the Senate, its own educational institutions. It has established boards of control to operate these institutions according to the directives of a synodical convention, the voice of the congregations. Secondly, however, the congregation may call someone who came through the colloquy route. This is a manner by which a person meeting the requirements of the professional ministry of the synod or as a teacher can come in without having graduated from one of the schools of the synod. He may come come in from one of the other denominations also, and pass the examination and have the rest of the qualifications, and they can call him. Mm-hmm. The third group they can call from are those churches with whom we are in fellowship. But that's the limit that we have prescribed in Article 6. You go and call someone from a fourth source,
yes,
and it becomes unconstitutional.
Right. Dr. Sifel, looks like we have about maybe 1 minute or a minute and a half just to say a few remarks concerning the number of resolutions in the workbook which has something or other to do in the area of congregational autonomy or polity, whatever you want to say. And I notice that they seem to be in two areas, concerning the AELC situation and concerning those congregations served by someone as pastor who did not graduate from one of our seminaries or enter, as you say, through the colloquy program or from one of our sister congregations. Maybe just say a word or two about those.
I'd like to emphasize that one of the concerns for decency and order,
yes,
of who qualifies for the ministry and who does not qualify, stemmed from a problem which existed in early America, not only in the Lutheran Church, but also in other churches. And this was the large number of tramp or vagabond preachers that were roving the country. They probably had been misfits in Europe, and so they came over here seeking pastoral employment. Now, to regularize those who were acceptable, the colloquy program was established. But to keep the others out, the other criteria were established. Now we've got the problem with the AELC situation. And I think that our floor committees, if I have been correctly informed, I think have given us a very fine series of guideposts by which the church can answer that contemporary problem that we are facing. And that is that the principle remains the same, that a congregation certainly cannot hold membership in two different churches simultaneously.
Yes.
I think we've always adhered to that kind of a principle. But since there are certain problems, and to look at them as pastorally and as evangelically as possible, as you cannot tell a drunkard in the congregation that unless he gives up his alcoholism at 12 o'clock on such and such a date, it really is not possible when a pastoral situation is involved to establish a kind of date by which people must do certain things. And so I think that our floor committees, instead of thinking in terms of the Dallas Convention as being a terminal date for congregations to make up their mind whether they are members of the AELC or the LCMS, is giving them additional time and has not, I believe, selected either September 1st for that matter, but rather to give them an opportunity to review, even to review the actions taken at Dallas, and then to think in terms of what they intend to do. Are they going to fish or cut bait? Are they going to be LCMS members or AELC members?
Right.
And I believe that the cutoff date now has been established in the future so that it will come, or it is recommended that it will come, about 30 days prior to that congregation's next district convention, which
All
I
right.
think gives them ample time to
right.
explore this situation
right.
in depth.
Sorry that our time is running out, Dr. Silfler. We thank you for this interview, and we certainly realize that this matter of congregational autonomy, or shall we say polity, how congregations fit into the synod is very important, and we ask the Lord's blessings in these matters also in our coming convention.
Thank you.